He even got a vote for Chef Boyardee. Why not?
There you go.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
You arresting us? Because we ain't do shit. The fuck, you just gonna hold us?
Real.
And that's what I've been saying this whole time, but she don't wanna listen with her cute ass.
Hey, shut up!
Hey, brilliant, man.
Where are your friends at, huh?
We ain't got no friends.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 104 of Wreckatopia. I'm Chris Atkinson. I am joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hi to Lee Hosen, Arenos.
And with Jeremy Scott.
That's me.
And today's big recommend is going to be Fruitvale Station. And once again, welcome chat who've come out here on a Tuesday to watch us talk about movies and food and junk and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, does anybody have any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Mm-hmm. I do. Me, coach. Put me in, coach. For a while there, Aaron was throwing a lot of awards contenders, small recommends at us because he got ready for his critic choice duties. And as I have been getting ready for an upcoming episode of this show where we go over all the films of 2023 or as many as we can, I'm catching up on a lot of films I haven't seen. And I saw Priscilla about 2 days ago, yesterday, 2 days, whenever the hell it was. Boy, did I have a good time with this movie. And I am not always a Sofia Coppola fan. I really like Virgin Suicides and Lost in Translation. I have come to like the Kirsten Dunst Let Them Eat Cake movie.
Marie Antoinette.
The Bling Ring didn't do much for me. I'm not sure which ones I'm missing there. But she has a very distinctive style in that her movies are almost dreamlike vignettes of people's moments, and it's hard to describe, but she's got a very unique voice, I think, in how she tells stories, and it just fits perfectly here. Kaylee Spaney has been great in everything I've seen her in, but is outstanding here, and she has so little dialogue to work with, and she has to use her face and her eyes for a lot of this. And Jacob Elordi is incredible as well, but I think Kaylee Spaney really steals this movie, and I appreciate, from my perspective, that the movie doesn't really try and show Elvis in an awesome light. Like, it's pretty obvious that he's in control and will be in control from the get-go. There are several scenes where they have phone conversations, and we don't even see him. We just hear his voice, and I can still palpably feel the verbal control and abuse coming through the phone, basically telling her how to feel and act. It's just, I don't know what I was expecting, but it's a perfect counterpoint to Baz Luhrmann's Elvis in almost every way. Colonel Tom Parker isn't even in this movie. He's just mentioned and referenced, but he's still a heavy presence. Yeah, I was blown away by the acting and the directing, and I think it's part of a story that needs to be told. We know the Elvis story, but this is a story that I, you know, from her perspective, had never seen. So there you go.
Very nice.
I've heard mixed reviews on this one. I'm not sure, but you may be the first one I've heard just been glowing about
it. It's 84 on Rotten Tomatoes. Not everybody's liking it. I get that.
Well, that seems pretty universal, though, 84. I, for some reason, thought that this was sort of DOA. Maybe it was all the hype coming up, leading up to the release of it. Like, there was, I guess, there was controversy about, there's always controversy about biopics. So,
sure.
So I had just assumed that it was one of those kind of like that Marilyn Monroe thing that, that came out, you know.
Oh, that movie's terrible, though. Yeah. That movie is so bad.
I thought it was going to be something in that kind of light.
Oh, I see. Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Kind of based on something fictional or whatever.
Right.
Aaron, did you see Priscilla?
Yeah.
What did you think?
I didn't love it. I didn't hate it either. I really like the things that you're talking about. I love there's an authenticity to this movie that I don't know that I've seen in any other kind of Elvis retrospective or movie or those kind of things, where you do really get a sense for the ugliness that was right underneath. You know, yep. Of, you know, the fact that she's so young, the fact that he was so controlling, you know, those kind of things. And a lot of that is because Sophia makes the very personal choice, and I think the right choice for this telling, to, in the name of the movie, to really make it Priscilla focused. Like, we're right. really in her world, and
she's
it's so
in, like,
easy.
Every single scene.
Yeah. And when it's somebody like that has the gravitational pull of an Elvis superstar, you know, level kind of experience that the world has with them, that's not always an easy choice to make, but to somehow make that gravitational pull be, you know, to let the moon be the star and, you know, or the, you know, the earth and not the sun, or whatever is interesting. So
I like that.
Yeah. I'll go next. I watched all the old Planet of the Apes movies, and I wanted to talk specifically about Beneath the Planet of the Apes as my small recommend. And yes, I am recommending it. it's not going to change your life, I don't think, but I really enjoyed the second movie. And I'll tell you the primary reason why. It makes some really interesting, bold choices in the second half of this movie. The first half is almost like a rehash of the original, just with a stand-in Charlton Heston. You know, in another astronaut who's, you know, come to figure out what's going on and those kind of things. But there's some really interesting stuff it does towards the end, and has one of the boldest endings I've ever seen in a movie. It is, the way this movie ends is, it's, I really liked it. So I was, you know, not sold throughout, but by the end I was like, oh, this is fun. These movies, and by the time I got through like Conquest and Battle for the Planet of the Apes, I just remember thinking, this is a nice little franchise. I really like what they put together here. And I really think it's cool that it gives more of a perspective for me on kind of what the new Apes movies are doing, which is basically taking Conquest and Battle and kind of making them what they could have been in some ways. I'd recommend The Journey if you find some time to go through the Apes movies. But I liked Beneath the Planet of the Apes. So yeah,
I've had the whole collection of this for a while, and I've only seen the first one. I've never seen the others. The used to be a thing, like TBS used to play all of these movies all the time. Like, they'd play the marathon and everything. I just never got around to watching them. So I think this is the first time I've heard someone recommend one of the sequels.
No, I know. In general, they're seen as kind of just like maybe cult classic-ish, but like cheesy, you know, 70s sci-fi kind of stuff. And I see where that comes from. But I think there's some really interesting world-building stuff going on in these movies.
The first one, I think, is legit.
Like, no, the first one is a legit classic. Absolutely, yeah.
And then they get goofy. Is Beneath, that's not the second one, is it?
Yeah, Beneath is the second one, so, and it's not goofy. The third one is goofy. The third one is a straight up like comedy, basically.
I don't even know how a third one happens.
Well, I will tell you, one of the things that would happen back in this time with sequels, they just release a new one every year. These movies came out consecutive years, like from 1970 to 74. There was a Planet of the Apes movie every year. So, like, they would just, you know, rock them through the system and put them out. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. One day I will do this, because I went through all the Dirty Harrys last year, and I went through, like, all the Friday the 13th this past year, and I went through, like, I'll get my hands on this whole collection at some point, whenever I have the time to do it. I watched another movie from the 70s, Rollerball, which had a infamous remake in 2001 that everybody bagged on when it came out. But this one in the 70s is much better, I assure you. but this one stars James Caan, and it's in a world where they are playing a sport that's a lot like roller derby, but it's got some added elements to it. And it's like kind of including a soccer-esque element, or a Quidditch, or whatever you want to call it, you know, where they've got a ball that they have to put into this little like circle, and that's how they score points. throughout, but it's very much like roller derby. And I think the movie isn't in like 100% success. They build a world that I think is really nice, but like don't really flesh it out the way they should. But it is entertaining to watch, and it's just a movie that's going to keep your attention all the way through. James Caan is on this team. He's on the Houston team of Rollerball, and like they play all over the world, and it's in a world where apparently there are no real nations anymore, and there was a so-called corporate wars that happened a few years ago, and that everything's kind of like murky and muddled at this point. And the movie seems to be making a lot of like statements about people not being able to feel anymore, not really being interesting anymore. And the only thing that they have for them is to watch stuff like Rollerball, which is extremely violent. And they've made the point with this is that this is a sport that's so violent. It's kind of like what you're thinking about with Running Man later on, that this is the only thing that's going to do it for us anymore. And James Caan is playing somebody who's been in the league for 10 years and he's a superstar in the sport. And his owner, played by John Houseman of the Smith Barney commercials fame, he and his executives want him to retire for some reason, but this is not something that he has been told in advance, and he doesn't know why. They don't give him a reason why wants him to retire, and they start changing the rules of the sport as it goes along, basically, I guess, in hopes that he will just die on the arena battlefield, basically, and everything. It's a very interesting movie. I don't think it's 100% great, but it is well worth watching, and especially if your only experience with this is the 2001 Chris Klein movie. So, you know,
I like how you called it a Chris Klein movie. Yeah. I mean, I don't really want to talk about the fact that McTiernan directed it either.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, it was McTiernan, unbelievably, who did that remake. But anyway, that was something I watched over the weekend. I thought it was very, very interesting. So there's my small recommend. All right, we're going on to the big recommend, which is Fruitville Station. Jeremy, take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Well, we had 2 weeks of comedy, and I brought it to a crushing close with this sobering movie based on a true story. It's Ryan Coogler's first feature-length film, and I think that's notable because it's an extremely confident film. We open with actual footage from bystanders of the Fruitvale Station event, where Oscar Grant is his last name.
Yep.
Yes. Was shot and killed. And then we cut back and we're going to spend the day with Oscar, leading up to, actually it cuts to black when we hear a gunshot. So if you don't know the story going in, you don't know that Oscar was killed. I knew the story going in. So we cut to just over a day earlier. It's New Year's Eve, and Oscar and his girlfriend are talking about his previous infidelity. And I appreciate how this movie treats Oscar like an onion, in that almost every scene we learn something new and major about who he is as a person. And I think a lesser film would have taken this first scene in the bedroom and panned over the dresser with pictures of the mom and the daughter and him getting out of jail and just try to tell us the whole story in one fell swoop. But this movie just meets it out to you a little bit at a time as we get to know this guy. He promises that the infidelity is over, and then they're about to get to sexy time when their daughter knocks on the door and wants to sleep in their bed. So the next morning we see the family getting ready in the kitchen and hustling out the door to take their daughter T to school, and then Sophina, his girlfriend, to work. Oscar calls his mom to figure out what her birthday dinner plans are, because New Year's Eve is his mom's birthday. And she scolds him for not using his earpiece while driving. I think it's fascinating that there are two relatives in this movie that give him shit about how and when he uses the phone. Later on, his grandma's ready to hang up on him when she thinks that he's called while on the clock. So she gives him shit about not using his earpiece. He sticks his phone up under his hat and tells her he's got the earpiece in. Then he goes to the supermarket to get crab, and interacts with another shopper there, as well as one of the employees, and he implies that he works there. At this time, we believe that he does. He helps this woman shopper figure out what kind of fish to buy by calling his grandmother and handing the phone to her. And then he goes to the supermarket boss and begs for his job back. And in my opinion, gets a little too physical in doing so, grabbing and trying to turn around the manager. And there are flashes of this, and we're going to find out more about, I think, where some of this comes from. But right now, I think it's coming from desperation. He's lost his job, and he's kind of a woman and a child to take care of. back at home, his sister calls and says that she needs to borrow some money, which of course we know he doesn't probably have. But also, she can't come to mom's birthday party tonight. And in one of my favorite gags, tells him not to get any white people cards, but to get a black person birthday card, which he promptly does the opposite of. Mm-hmm. And I love that we never get to see the payoff. I love that we never get to see her like screaming at him over it. But we know that probably would have happened. So while getting gas, he befriends a dog. And one of the hardest scenes to watch as he wanders back to the car, the dog is struck by another car driving by, which then takes off. And it's traumatic. And he picks up the dog and carries it to the sidewalk, and the dog dies. He goes to the beach. He's going to do a drug deal. He's going to sell some weed. And this is where we get a flashback while he's sitting there waiting. And it shows him in prison. And he's having a visit with his mom. And it's tender. It's mother, son. That's clearly there's a loving relationship there. And then another prisoner walks by and says, "Oh, is this your mom?" And he snaps into an entirely different person. I think he has to. I think this is what prison does to people, is that it forces you to, I don't know, act like you're tough enough to defend yourself at all times. And these guys go back and forth. There's lots of F-bombs. His mom is clearly disturbed, but he doesn't. It's almost like he's forgotten she's even there in the moment. Mm-hmm. And then he sits back down, and she repeatedly had asked about his eye. He's got a mark on his under his eye. He's clearly been beaten up or something. And every time she asks, he changes the subject. And so she tells him she's not going to come anymore to visit him in prison. And it's pretty devastating. He asks her for a hug as she's walking out, and she just keeps walking. And again, the movie is not telling us every single bit of his story. It's giving us these vignettes. And so it's hard for me to parse that scene and know exactly how many times she's come to visit. Has he been getting in fights in prison that extend his term? That's kind of the vibe that I got, was that if he was on better behavior, he could get out sooner. But it's not clear. And either way, the point is she's not going to come back anymore. So then we cut back to the beach. But before the buyer arrives, he dumps the weed in the ocean in a scene that had me leaping out of my chair screaming, "No, no, don't do that." Sorry, that was a joke. It's good for him to be doing this. He's trying to get away from this criminal life. So the buyer shows up and he lies and says, "Oh, I sold it to this white guy." And he pulls a blunt and a little tiny bag of weed down from his visor and gives it to the guy. And again, I'm reading into this, but I feel like this is him saying, maybe I'm going to be done smoking too, not just done selling or what have you. But the other guy does light up briefly and puff. And later on, Oscar gets in trouble for it because his girlfriend smells it. Anyway, we then cut to Safina's work, where she's waiting with the cake. She seems impatient. I don't know how long she's been standing there, but I get the sense it's been more than 10 seconds. She's angry when the car smells like weed. He doesn't tell her that it's from the buyer who smoked the blunt before he got out. Then we go to Safina's grandmother's house. This is when we learn that this is where she technically lives. This is where all her stuff is, at the very least, even though we saw her spending the night at Oscar's. And she presses Oscar what's wrong, and he finally admits that he lost his job and that he lost it 2 weeks prior. And she is understandably angry. But he does eventually tell her that he dumped the weed. And she says, I think something like, "I should punch you for that. I should slap you for that." But at the same time, I think she gets the point. He even says, literally, "I want to try doing something legal." And then they get busy. Then we cut to mom's birthday party. And I think this is just a lovely scene. It's just warm and full of love and tradition, and you know, just it's clear that all these people are really familiar with each other and love each other. After the party, while washing dishes, Oscar's mother suggests that he and his friends take the train into the city instead of driving. That broke me again, because I know where the story is going ahead of watching. That broke me. I have to believe a lot of this is true to life, because Oscar's real mother plays the preschool teacher in this movie. And so, and I also read that Coogler sat down with the family and was, go ahead.
I read a pretty detailed article on what things were added to the movie and what were researched, and her suggesting them riding the train is true. That was one of the things.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That did happen.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Then they take Tea, their daughter, to Sophina's sister's house, where there are just kids everywhere. I think there's five or six of them running around. And we get a nice little touching father-daughter scene as he's saying goodnight. And she says she's scared because she hears gunshots. And he says, those are just firecrackers. It's going to be fine. And that broke me as well. Then all of his friends, and they hit the BART train to ride into the city, and the mood is good until there's a slight delay that threatens to cause them to miss the countdown of the new year. But then one of the guys pulls out his phone and another guy pulls out some speakers, and they just start having a dance party in this train car that's going nowhere. And I had a really good time with that. And then Oscar notices the time and leads everybody in a countdown to New Year's Eve. Then they get off the car and the streets are wild. It's a crazy party. And it's kind of implied that they spend some time partying. But obviously at some point a bathroom is needed. Oscar negotiates with a business owner who's closing his business to let these two ladies in his party go in and use the bathroom. And then a couple shows up, a man and a pregnant woman, and he negotiates her ability to go use the bathroom as well. And then has an interesting conversation with this guy about marriage. And the guy's, he says, you know, I wanted to wait to get a ring until everything was, you know, was perfect, until I could afford it. And the guy's like, bad decision. Like, doesn't even miss a beat. Just, and it basically encourages him to get married when you have nothing, because love is all that you need. And I just think that's a really, I hope that story is true too. It may not be. That feels like one of the things that may have been added in for dramatic purposes. Anyway, they get back on the train to go home, and the camera just sits in the station as the train leaves and disappears into darkness. And I thought it was a pretty interesting shot. The train is super crowded, but then Oscar's recognized by the gal he helped in the grocery store earlier. She calls out his name, and then a nearby guy hears the name and recognizes Oscar from prison and yells out the initials of some gang. It's the same gang the guy he argued with in the flashback had yelled.
Yeah, is DGF a thing, or is it just a... I don't think it is. I don't think it's a gang, but they may have just not wanted to say a real name of a gang.
That could be.
Don't give a fuck is what I thought, really. Oh. But it could just be that that's what they're calling the gang in there. I didn't quite understand that.
So. Mm-hmm. And so a fight starts. Oscar, of course, has a lot of his friends there, and so they're able to push the attacker off the train, and then they eventually get off the train but see cops and realize that cops might have been called because of this scuffle on the train. They decide to separate. Cops start grab three guys and set them on the ground. And then one cop comes on the train, looks at Oscar, assumes Oscar's part of the problem, and pulls him off the train, throws him on the ground with the other three. The police seem to know that there was a group of friends involved in this fight, because we see them slowly grabbing the rest of Oscar's friends and dragging them and cuffing them and bringing them to this location. Oscar films and tells the cop he has his badge number, but then when he's ordered to put the phone away, he doesn't. He tries to stand up to resolve the situation and is pushed back down. He tells the cop they can't arrest him for doing nothing, and the lead cop orders him arrested immediately, or cuffed immediately, and then starts using the N-word. And a scuffle results. We end up with Oscar on his stomach, two cops on top of him, and one of the cops pulls a gun and fires. The cops then force everyone onto the train, and they realize they're being filmed. The train takes off as Oscar gasps for breath. Sophina is down below. She exited before everybody else, and now they won't let her back up. So she's panicking, when one of Oscar's arrested friends walks by and says they shot him. Then a gurney comes by with Oscar on it, and all she can get out of anyone is which hospital they're taking him to. We cut to the hospital and see doctors assessing Oscar. They say we need to get him upstairs right away. It's very clear that this is a very dire situation. Safina and Oscar's mom arrive. We learn that Oscar has lost a lung and has massive internal bleeding, and his mother leads all of his friends in prayer. Oscar dies. His mother is asked to see the body and is allowed to, but she's not allowed to go in and touch him because it's been declared a homicide, according to the doctor. So she has to stand outside a window, and she blames herself for telling him to take the train. Safina picks up tea from her sister's. T asks where her daddy is and seems to know the answer before she's told, but we cut to black. The post-film text says that the killing led to riots and that the officer who shot Oscar was charged with first-degree murder. He was notably released after serving only 11 months on a measly two-year sentence after the jury found him guilty only of involuntary manslaughter because he said he thought his gun was his taser. And then before the credits, we get more real-world footage of Fruitvale Station as people gathered to mourn and call for change. And that is Fruitvale Station. Which one of you guys wants to give your thoughts first?
And I think that final footage is 4 years later, too. I think that was right when the movie came out in 2013. That footage was from that year.
Shot the footage just before it went to the festival that it got picked up at. Yeah.
I read something about that.
Yep.
It's one of those weird movies to say you adore, right? Like I adore this movie for everything that it's saying, for everything that it's shining light on. There's something with these movies where it's really important to look. Our instinct is to look away, right? Our instinct is to not want to think about these things. Our instinct is to shelter ourselves from the grossness and the terribleness and the darkness of so many things that happen in our world. And I think artists for a long time have taken up the idea of, no, look at this. And I think Coogler is doing that in this movie in a really, really powerful way. I think the shot that exemplifies this the most for me is as Oscar Grant lays dying, we get a silent, slow-mo, beautiful moment of him doing piggyback with his daughter. Just this beautiful moment. And Coogler lets us have that beauty and that hope and that idea that there was joy in this life, that there were, you know, were these positive things. And then in a hard cut, we cut to an empty blood transfusion bag hitting a trash can. Mm. And it's a devastating cut. And it's so purposeful to go, look what was taken away. Look at it. I want you to be hurt by this. I want you to understand this on a deep level, the humanity of this. And it's just, it's powerful filmmaking. And he does this throughout the movie. He's never afraid to let Oscar Grant be a real person. In fact, I think he's even talked about the idea that he didn't want to fall into the polarization narratives, right? Like the idea that one side says this is a bad person who was always in prison and had these bad things that they did and, you know, and make that the narrative. And then the other side, you know, it wants to ignore those things and just say, you know, this is a beautiful person. And Coogler says, I'm not buying into any of that. Here is who this person was. Flaws, beautiful things, joy. And I think it's a testament to the idea that with humanity, we just need to quit putting people in buckets and just saying this is a good person or this is a bad person or, you know, based on the choices they've made or the things that they've done. And I just think this movie really, really explores that very, very well. And it's just such a moving movie in so many ways. And a lot of that, I mean, MBJ is just so good in this movie. Uh-huh. It's so clear the talent he has. Right from the beginning. It's interesting to see pre-Creed shirtless MBJ in that first scene and just go, oh, look at him. Oh, MBJ, he's just like us.
You should watch Hardball one time just for like 9-year-old Michael B. Jordan
in that movie. Well, he was in The Wire too, right? Like,
but he was older. He was like a teenager.
Where's Wallace? Wallace?
I have other things I can say, but Chris, why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about the movie?
And I know the movie doesn't go over the narrative, but I've always hated that narrative where they come up, they're like, well, this guy was a criminal or he went to jail or something. Yeah. And it's always after the fact.
Yep.
It's never like in the moment they know that this person is, you know, has a record or anything, but afterwards you find out, he did this. Oh my God. Well, he must have deserved this or whatever. So I've always hated that. This movie for me is one of those where like that doom is just constantly in the frame of the movie. Like one thing that Coogler does in this is constantly has subway trains running in the background. And it's just the movie starts off, you know where this is going to end at a subway station. You see these subway just kind of randomly going down the tracks in the background. Even the dead dog scene's got one where it's just like this is sort of just looming in the background. All the choices that you make. I mean, I don't think we're supposed to necessarily, I think we're supposed to understand that the decisions that you make in this movie, the decisions they made are not something that you could have foreseen that would have led to your death or anything. We beat ourselves up over decisions we make that we have absolutely no information for. You shouldn't have to worry about getting killed because you made some sort of decision Octavia Spencer telling him to take the BART is the absolute correct decision. They're going to be drinking. They're going to be like, you know, there's going to be multiple, there's like more than four or five. So, I mean, you know, in their group. So it's like, how are they going to do this in a car anyway? It would have been dangerous. It would have been super dangerous to drive around in a car. And who knows what would have happened in that situation. And then like, so it's constantly like all these decisions in the movie sort of lead to this impending doom. I don't know if the movie's saying, oh, look at that. If only this had happened, he wouldn't have died. I hope it's not saying that. I don't think it is. But there are all these decisions, like they delay getting on the train at first, when they're going back, the having to pee and that, you know, that whole waiting part of it. They get in on the train just as the doors are closing. There's all those little things that just sort of add up to like, well, if they could have just gotten on another train, or if, you know, if they could have just missed that train, we would have dodged this. But I just love how, you know, it's the whole movie is just sort of like, you know, just, it's just saying that this is, it's just a constant, like, I don't know, that impending doom is in that movie the entire time. Mm-hmm. There's hardly, and I'm glad you brought up the scene, Aaron, with them cutting away to his daughter or like after that cut or whatever, because there's hardly anything in this movie that's like, oh, I can really rest on this as something that's like really good, you know. And just, I don't know, man, you know, the movie does not make a statement as to whether this cop is doing this on purpose or whatever. I mean, I think we all know he didn't know what the difference between his taser and his gun. We all know that's bullshit, but in a jury room, that's going to appeal to a few people. And that's all you need is just a few people to be like, yeah, I guess you could do that, you know? And I know that we always go through this whole thing where it's like, we don't know how dangerous a cop's job is and they're always on the edge and all this other stuff, but man, it just needs to be some better training than this, because there was no reason to pull anything out during this. You had the situation under control.
Yeah, even there was no threat.
Even if there's yelling, even if they're yelling at you, what is yelling going to do? Just, you had the situation. They're sitting down. They're not doing anything. And it's just, that's the part that always, I'm like, yeah, I know your job is really tough. I get it. You're like, death is around the corner everywhere you go, but man, you just seems like just too ready to pull that gun out at any moment. Just too ready, too scared. You know, you're just going to have, I don't know what the answer is, because you can't find 100% of people who are just going to be stone faced, brave in every situation, but man, there's just people who are just too scared to run to do that job a lot of times. So
the chat is letting us know that some of them thought the guy on the train fighting him was the same guy.
I think it was the same.
It was the same guy. In fact, it's the one part of the movie I question Coogler's choices just a little bit. Is the there's such a massive convenience to the 1-2 punch of the girl he just happened to give cooking instructions to being on the train to yell his name that is then recognized by the guy he just happened to be in prison with to start this all off. Now, if you look at the true story, from my understanding, from what I remember, from what I read, it was somebody he was in prison with that he got in a little scuffle with on the train. And I think eyewitnesses said they did nothing more than wrestle. Like, I don't even think there were really even punches thrown from what I can understand. But it was somebody he was in prison with, but there wasn't the woman he gave cooking instructions to was not, you know, a part of that. That was a separate story from a separate time of something his grandma remembered that he called him her one time and asked for, you know, cooking instructions for someone. So
I do appreciate what you said, Aaron, about how the movie doesn't make him perfect. Doesn't try to deify him at all.
No, not at all. The first thing we know about him is that he's cheating. That's the first thing we know about him.
And I think the movie's saying that even flawed lives have value and can bring joy. And I appreciate that in the midst of all the doom that you're talking about, Chris, the movie gave me one of my biggest laughs I've had in months. And I think it may be because of the doom, because I'm in this place of dread. And so any unexpected moment of levity maybe gets a bigger laugh than I expect. But when they get on the train, there's a pair of girls sitting down, and one of them says to Oscar's friends, "I like your dreads." And he says, "I like your everything." And the girl puts her arm around her and says, "We gay." And the guy next to the friend puts his arm around the friend and says, "Sounds like a coincidence. We gay too." And I lost it. I had to pause the movie. I was laughing so hard. I had already told my wife I was watching this tragic fucking movie. And then she hears me cackling like that. And I had to explain for like five minutes.
And then Michael B. Jordan even is like, "Oh, yeah. Yeah, they mad gay or something like that."
Aren't we gay? And then later on at midnight, all the guys react when they see those girls kiss like they're horny guys.
Something you said, Jeremy, struck a memory with me. You mentioned like both the movie letting Oscar be who he is as a complete human being. And also, Chris, you mentioned that doom, which, by the way, is completely intentional. There's a reason we start with the actual footage.
Yep.
Coogler is saying, I want you to know where this is going. I want you to feel that this day is going to end in tragedy right from the beginning. So like that doom is definitely purposeful. But the way it's combined with those moments of hope, that balance of who this person is really, really impressive. The example that came to mind when I was thinking when you were talking, Jeremy, was the 1-2 punch in the supermarket when he's talking to that, when he does this amazing thing where he gets his grandma on the phone and gets her this recipe or whatever, and then immediately threatens his former boss to get his job back. Like immediately goes to him and is not only like, you know, "What do you want me on the street selling drugs?" but follows it up with, "Maybe I'm waiting for you outside of the store one day."
Yeah.
Like this is the, like Coogler is saying, like both of these things are true. They are both part of this human being. Reconcile with that however you need to. It doesn't change the fact that his life mattered. Like that's, you know, so yeah, I just think that's really spectacular stuff.
Yeah, and it is a lesser movie that will just say, well, nothing ever, he never did anything wrong, had an evil thought or anything like that. Because then once the movie comes out and everybody like realizes, oh, there was kind of some shady stuff to him or whatever, it starts to ring a lot more false when your movie comes out and it's just like, you know, here's this hero or whatever, or what do you want to cut, whatever you want to call it. But I agree. I really enjoyed the fact that they didn't pull back on that and showed that he had the capability of being a bad guy if he wanted to be.
So all right, anybody got any last thoughts before we move to the double features?
I think I covered everything I wanted to say, except for maybe just explicitly saying, I mean, Coogler, what a talent right from the beginning. Just like insane to do this for your debut.
Apparently,
it's wild.
Forrest Whitaker like shepherded his career after seeing his student films. And also it's worth pointing out, Octavia Spencer, who's great in this movie, was a producer on this movie. And when they ran out of money, offered to play the role for free.
Right.
So this movie is great because everyone behind the camera and in front of it really cared about getting it made and getting it made well. So, all right. Well, why don't you give me a super secret double feature?
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I can start. I really only had one choice for this. It's not perfect, but it is perfect for me. And part of the reason has to do with my experience with this film. But I'm going with Do the Right Thing as my super secret double feature. And I came to Do the Right Thing very, very late. I saw this movie for the first time just a few years ago. And of course, this movie is almost 30 years. I think it was 89. I think this movie came out. So it's been a while. And when I saw this movie and what that this movie is touching on, the same things as Fruitvale Station, police brutality, racial relations, ends in much the same tragedy as Fruitvale Station ends. And I had one of those moments where I think I cried. I just cried for maybe 5 to 10 minutes about my own ignorance. I was alive in 1989. Yes, I was 14 years old, and I wasn't quite an adult. But that black people for so long have been crying out and saying, "Look at this injustice," and it's only been within the last 10 years, the last decade, that I've woken up is a personal tragedy of my own that I wept over and vowed to keep my eyes open and not to be lost in my own privilege so much that I don't realize the struggle of so many others. Because the message has been out there for a while. The message was out there before Do the Right Thing, but it was just that movie that kind of hit me in that way. So, that's the very personal reason that these are a good one to combination for me.
Interestingly enough, this one was mine as well.
Okay.
But I had a few backups just in case. The reason why I had Do the Right Thing on here is, yes, once again, you have at the very end of this movie, you have cops who are just going well over the situation, what the situation calls for at the end of the movie. And just, they choke Radio Raheem at the end of the movie, and it's just, and they yell out the name. I don't remember the guy's name, but it was one of the more famous wrongful death situation, and I can't remember the guy's name. They throw that name out there, and that had been one of the the name that had been on everybody's lips for a long time before Rodney King and before a lot of these started becoming more public. I wanted to go and Do the Right Thing also takes place in one day too. That's another one.
And it's also a fairly new director, making a statement too. I know he had done a movie before this, but it was one of Spike Lee's first movies. So
yeah, he had done like School Days and She's Gotta Have It, I think, just before this, but it was definitely, he was definitely still pretty new. But one other one that I came up with, this one does not really fit it, but it's also got the all done in one night. Trains make a big appearance in this movie, and it's got some of that. It's got some of the topics of Fruitvale Station in it, but not, it's more in the background and everything. And that's The Warriors. And I feel like The Warriors would be a good complement to this movie, not because they're the same movie, but I think they would go well together in certain ways. They don't exactly fit. Obviously another one that I thought of that was like really conventional was like Blind Spotting, which, you have the same area, you have the same things that we're talking about in that movie. In this one. So, but I wanted to kind of go away from the exact match movie And the Warriors seem to fit that mold for me because it's all on the same night. It's got the subway stuff. I thought it was a pretty good one overall. So, and yeah, someone writes Polar Express and I'm like, yeah, yeah.
That was almost right after you said, has the trains, and then before you mm-hmm. revealed what your movie was,
yeah. Okay, well, next week is going to be the best of 2023 podcast. So that's your homework. Watch all the movies of 2023. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you can follow along with us. Jeremy and I have to do some catching up. I've been catching up all month. I did this thing last year where I tried to watch like 40 movies in 3 days or something. And
I know that feeling.
And it worked, but. Man, I'm not doing that again. I'm never doing that again. but that's going to be it. The best of 2023 is next, and then we'll get back on the normal track. Do we have some questions?
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
We have some questions. Any questions? Right. What celebrity chef, living or dead, would you like to share a meal with?
I'm going to go with a very basic answer, Gordon Ramsay, just because he's entertaining and I think he would be a great conversationalist, obviously. And he's just the guy. Every time I see him in anything, just the way he talks, I just want to hear him talk. I don't care what he says, and just like how he talks. So
we did eat at his restaurant in LA.
We did
in 2014, and they gave us ceviche that had popcorn. That was a great meal.
Yeah.
But I don't think he was there or anything.
No. He's never there.
No. Never there.
Aaron? I know it doesn't say living, dead, or fantasy, but I went with Remy from Ratatouille. that would be amazing. But if we're going with people in the real world, I do have a couple names I wanted to throw out. One, Chris, involved a meal that you and I had. I would love to do a meal with Nyesha Arrington. We went to her restaurant in Los Angeles, and she was on Top Chef.
We went to her restaurant.
Yeah.
I had forgotten about that.
Had some of the best short rib I've ever tasted.
Oh, it was so good.
Yeah.
Oh, man. What was that restaurant called?
I'd have to look it up. I have a picture. I don't remember. It was one word, but Native? Maybe Native?
Yes, it was called Native. That's what it was called.
Yeah.
I totally forgotten about this. I've seen her on Next Level Chef, and mm-hmm. I just completely escaped my mind that I went to one of her restaurants. Yeah.
That was really good. But I think my actual answer is Dave Chang. And mm-hmm. I think he's such a – I've listened to him on some podcasts. I think he has this really full view of food that I think would appeal to me, and we'd have good conversations. He's very populist in some of his food loves. I think Domino's pizza is like one of his favorite things. Like, and he talks about the way their new pizza combines different flavors. And like, so he's, you know, he loves a good grilled cheese. Like he's, you know, he understands that there's more to food than just the idea of, you know, experimentation, that there's some real classicness to these populist ideas of peanut butter and jelly or grilled cheese or, you know, those kind of things. So, mm-hmm. I would love to hang out with Dave Chang.
I'm going with Tom Colicchio, in part because I have eaten his food as well. Mm-hmm. And also, because he has been on Top Chef, every season of Top Chef, and I have seen him interviewed, and outside of the world of food, I think he would be an incredible conversationalist with food. But outside of the world of food, I just think he's a very, very intelligent, well-read. I'd just like to have a conversation about almost darn near anything with that guy. And I think he would say something profound.
He's the craft guy, right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yep, he's the one in craft.
In the chat, we have Polly Walnut says, Julia Child. Yeah, absolutely. We even got a vote for Chef Boyardee. Why not?
There you go.
And Giada De Laurentiis. I don't know who that is. Do you guys know?
Yep. She's on the Food Network.
Okay.
She's pretty popular. I don't think she's technically, I think she's one of those that can't call herself a chef because she didn't go to culinary school. But she does a bunch of cooking shows. She's great.
Got to vote for Bobby Flay or Jet Tila, Andrew Ray, who's binging with Babish, Alton Brown, and go on to the next question.
All right, the next question. What are some unsung car chase movie scenes that don't get enough love?
Have you guys ever seen We Own the Night?
No.
Yes.
Joaquin Phoenix, Eva Mendes, Robert Duvall.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
This has an extremely unsung car chase scene in it. It's in the rain. Joaquin Phoenix is in a car with Eva Mendes. They're being driven by somebody. His dad, Robert Duvall, who's a cop, is in a car in the front. And they're supposed to have a car behind them that is supposed to watch out for them. And at some point, Joaquin Phoenix says, "Hey, where's that car that's supposed to be behind us?" And then this other car comes up to the right and starts shooting at them. Ooh. And so then they have to back off. They actually shoot the driver of the car. So Phoenix has to go into the front seat and get the car under control and everything. And it's just everything is from his perspective at this point. You see the car with the gunman come up to where Duvall is, and everything is just very visceral and real. Like, the gunshots aren't super loud. You hear it from his perspective. So it's just a boop, 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 boop. And you just see stuff from a distance. And there's a point where a guy leans out of the car with his big rifle and just shoots. And you see Duvall just go like that. That car chase is amazing, and nobody ever talks about it. And I think it's because it's not a traditional car chase where it's just like guy chasing after another guy, and it's fun, it's visceral. You see low angle shots of the tires on the road and all that stuff. But that's one that has stuck with me for years. I haven't seen the movie in forever, but that scene has stuck with me forever.
I can't remember that movie, but I know I saw it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you already answer, Dicer?
No, you want me to?
Yeah, go ahead.
We're going with Wanted. Angelina Jolie, James McAvoy.
Curving the bullet.
Yeah. Well, this car chase starts with her capturing James McAvoy into the car in a skid, and it just gets more insane from there. It's the geography is really shot well in this chase as well. You always know like where they're going, what's going on. There's this whole section where Angelina Jolie is out the front of the vehicle while James McAvoy is driving, and she's laying on her back while shooting backwards at, like, there's so many things in the scene that I just hadn't seen before. I just remember going, this is incredible. I actually like Wanted. I like Salt too. I like a lot of Angelina Jolie's action stuff. Isn't
Wanted the one that ends with everything is being controlled by a magical loom?
Yeah.
Yes, you're correct.
All right. Just wanted to make sure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I recently rewatched Jack Reacher, the first one with Tom Cruise. And there's a really cool intermittent inner city car chase. It's at night and there's a lot of alleys being used and cross streets. And there's two entities chasing him, police and criminals. And he's in this red muscle car. And it's just a really cool cat and mouse kind of game. Because the chase starts and stops, and he gets seen again, and it starts again. But then, eventually, he's going down like a 5-lane center road in downtown, and there's people on the corner waiting for a bus, and he basically sticks something on the gas pedal and just steps out of the car and calmly walks over to the corner, and the car is just rolling slowly and hits something. I think it hits police cars and stops. And a guy standing on the corner hands Tom Cruise a hat. He puts it on, and then the next thing you see, he's on the bus driving out. I just really like that sequence. I like that movie, I think, more than maybe most people do, but I like that sequence a lot.
We got the original Gone in 60 Seconds on here. James Kinder says, James Gray regards the We Own the Night chase as a failure, which is sad because it rules. I'm always interested in that when I believe in a director more than they do. I've always found that weird. It's like Quentin Tarantino and Death Proof, man. I heard him on the Hot Fuzz commentary talking about how much he fucked that up when he directed it. And I was like, No, I love that movie. Yeah, Six Underground. I'd never seen that. And then, of course, we got some jokey ones.
Oh, Six Underground. That's a good choice. Yeah, that opening car chase in Six Underground is amazing. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
Because, you know, people are talking about Days of Thunder and I like put Mitchell in there. The Blues Brothers.
The Lunar Rover chase and Ad Astra.
That's a good choice, too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Someone puts Matrix 2. I think that's a troll.
See you next week, mister.
If you know the history of us, that's a troll. All right. Well, next week will be the year in review for 2023. Once again, chat, thank you for coming out and watching us today. We appreciate you very much. And we will see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Hello.
Jerry?
Phil?
Phil Connor?
Phil Connor?
So at the dentist, I made the classic mistake of actually answering the question, what do you do?
Oh.
Because I had a new dental hygienist today. I was just caught off guard. Normally, I will say I'm a writer or something, or I'm video editor or something, just to try and tell the truth without having to expound too much, because every answer, when I start telling the truth, every answer leads to another question. So
yep.
What do you do? I said, I run a YouTube channel. And she's like, oh, what kind of videos do you make? I was like, oh, we make videos that make fun of movies. Oh, what's the channel name? Oh, it's called Cinema Sins. Oh, like S-I-N-S? I was like, yeah, we do these kind of like guy in his basement thinks he knows everything, nitpicky recaps of movies. And she's like, oh, have you done Saltburn? And
I
was like,
I had a dentist appointment this week as well.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Something tells me your teeth are in a lot better shape than mine.
Yeah, I usually get the, well, nice to have you in. See you in 6 months. You know, that's usually what I get. I have some receding gum stuff, but that's pretty much it. I never deal with cavities, or I think I was taught pretty early how to brush well, and I think that's just kind of kept me in a good place.
I was taught pretty early how to brush well and did that right up until I went to college, and then I just kind of brushed like an ass for 6 or 8 years.
Have you ever done this? I did this morning. It's funny, we're talking about dental.
Mm-hmm.
I have an electric toothbrush, so... Mm-hmm. I was getting everything ready this morning and started using the electric toothbrush. And I guess it's because I had used an electric razor beforehand. Something tricked my mind into thinking I wasn't actually brushing my teeth at the time. And I was looking down at the charger for the electric toothbrush, and I was like, where's my electric toothbrush? And it's in my mouth at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sitting there brushing my teeth and going, where is the... I was looking all over. I was like, did I do something with it last night that I don't realize?
That's amazing. That's the brain is so awesome. I literally last week put on my glasses to search for my glasses. Like, yeah. It was like, you know, are they over there? And I put, you know, like, I think they were up on my head. And so I like dropped them down and I was looking around. I was like, oh, you idiot.
I thought you were going to say, Chris, that you started rubbing the outside of your...
Do you, either of you guys use delivery services like Walmart Delivery, anything like that, for groceries?
No.
I actually signed up for Walmart Plus, but apparently there's some other echelon where you get the, like, I don't know, the free, I haven't looked into it.
I think it's just Walmart Plus. That's what we do. We do Walmart Plus and we get free delivery.
I did it one day. I got some soft drinks through them once. Uh-huh. But the thing is that they don't have the stuff that I get at my Publix that I go to. So I tend to just go to the Publix. So, yeah. But things like that are just easy, just anywhere you can get them. That's that I will use them on occasion.
Yeah, we love it. It works really well for our family. Had my first issue with it last night. And learned something that I found really, really interesting. So I wanted to share it with you guys. But I had a delivery scheduled for the last delivery of the night, like 9 p.m. I needed bananas for my smoothie this morning. Look, I cannot live without a banana in my smoothie. So I needed one. So I set up an order for like 9 p.m. last night. It gets to be about 10 or so, and it's like not there. And I get this. So I go into the app and it says, your order has been delayed for maybe 2 hours or something like that. And I was like, well, that's like after you close pretty much. So I don't know what's going on at this point. And I was like, you know what? The stuff I ordered, if they do bring it, can live on the porch. I didn't order like milk or anything like that. It can live on the porch overnight and it'll be fine, whatever. So I get up this morning, still not there. So I call them and I say, hey, what happened to my delivery last night? And they said, as if I'm supposed to know what this means, they said, the driver had a shedding dog in their car. That's their explanation.
You've never had a piece of produce that wasn't up to your standards.
No, we get bananas every time, and they're always good.
I go to the grocery store, the bananas available to pick aren't always even
good. So here's what I will say, Jeremy, and this may be part of it. I don't care. If I go to the store, I'm just grabbing banana. Like, I'm not like a banana. If it's like too green, maybe I won't grab it. But, you know, like, I'm not overly concerned about, I'm not picky.
I'm the guy that touches 25 onions before I choose which onion I'm putting in my cart. We should bring a camera sometime when I'm shopping for cucumbers. You should just watch me shopping for cucumbers,
That'll be your OnlyFans. Watch Jeremy handle his cucumber.
Yep.